Resonance 104.4 FM. The art of listening. Boom, boom, boom.
Now they often call me Speedo, but my real name is Mister. Now they often call me Speedo, but my real name is Mister. No, for meeting brand new fellas and taking other folks' girls. Well, now they often call me Speedo, cause I don't believe in wasting time. Well, now they often call me Speedo, cause I don't believe in wasting time. Well, I'm known for pretty women, and I cause them to change their mind. Well, now some may call me Joe, some may call me Mo. That's Mama Speedo, he don't ever take it slow. Well,
welcome to the Bike Show on Resonance FM with me, Jack Thurston. On this week's show, an extraordinary story. It's a story about the global economy. It's a story of high tech, high stakes, and high ambitions. It's a story about cutthroat rivalry in a pioneering new industry made up of hundreds of small startup companies. It's a story about young, gifted engineers and canny entrepreneurs. It's a story that would feel right at home in California's Silicon Valley. But it's not a story about the dot-com boom. It's a story about the bicycle boom. The bicycle boom of the 1890s. At its heart is the Raleigh Bicycle Company, a company that would go on to become the biggest bike manufacturer in the world. Raleigh was founded in Nottingham by Frank Bowden, a man who in his early 20s had made a fortune investing in the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. Seeking a cure for a serious, potentially terminal illness, Bowden discovered cycling. He believed the bicycle had saved his life, and moreover, he thought it could make him a lot of money. Frank Bowden transformed bicycle making from a craft practiced in small backstreet workshops into a factory production line. As well as the mass production of bicycles, Bowden sought to acquire patents for the best new bicycle components, the components that he needed to put Raleigh machines ahead of the competition. One component in particular was vital to Raleigh's commercial success, and it's a component that remains a part of many bicycles today, the hub gear. When you say hub gear, I say Sturmey Archer, and I don't think I'm the only one. Sturmey Archer is a name that sits alongside Michelin, Campagnolo and Brooks in the pantheon of iconic bicycle brands. But the strange thing about Sturmey Archer is that neither Sturmey nor Archer invented the hub that bears their names. Bicycle historian Tony Hadland takes up the story of the quest to produce a bike with more than one gear.
Well, in the 1860s, when the first commercially made bicycles with cranks came on the market in France, even at that stage, there were patents aimed at trying to create multiple gearing, two or three speed gears. They didn't really come to much at the time, and then people were distracted by the evolution of the high bicycle, the penny farthing or ordinary. And once that had settled down to a different design, when the rear driving safety bicycle came on the scene, we had equal size wheels. We were no longer dependent on the wheel size for the speed of transmission. We could vary that with a chain drive. Then there was a resurgence of interest in bicycle gears. All sorts of different techniques had been tried, but most of them were pretty cumbersome. There were very early derailleurs, which were very clunky, and a number of other systems. But the breakthrough came with the compact epicyclic hub gear.
Okay, come on. I'm going to have to stop you there. Let's go into how it works.
Right. And that's quite tricky. The hub gear looks very straightforward. Basically a sort of magic cocoa tin. There's all this stuff going on. And I remember in Richard's bicycle book, which we all read many years ago, he said, don't try taking one of these apart, because when you put it back together again, you'll have enough spare bits left over to make a cuckoo clock. And there's an element of truth in that. But the basic principle is quite simple. It's what's called sun and planet gearing. And in the centre is what they call a sun wheel. It's a cog wheel that's on the axle of the bike. And that's fixed. That's just sitting there. And then rolling around that are various little pinion wheels, little cog wheels. You only need one, theoretically, but in practice they tend to have more. But just imagine one of those rolling around. It's getting spin on it because it's rolling around with its teeth engaging with the sun wheel. And that extra spin it gets is then translated into additional motion, which goes into a gear ring that runs around that. So the little cog is running around, picking up extra motion from the sun wheel and transferring that to the inside of the hub. So the wheel itself is rotating faster than the input. That's one of the modes. By either switching in or switching out the engagement of these various cogs, you can either make the wheel itself go faster or slower. But it's all to do with the additional motion gained by the little wheel, the little planet wheel, rolling around the sun.
So if I can explain what I just heard to see if I've got it right. It's almost like an onion with various layers. You've got the central bit of the onion, and then you've got another layer, which is the pinion sort of layer, and then you've got the outside of the hub, the sort of skin, which is doing the moving of the spokes.
Absolutely.
Essentially.
Yeah,
so you've got these intermediary, which is variable. You can take out one size of intermediary cog and put in another, and that will give you essentially a different gear.
Yes, you can think of it in terms of the centre of the onion is static, and then your inner layer, if you put the drive into the inner layer and take it, it will then make the outer layer go faster, or if you put the drive into the outer layer, it will make the inner layer go slower. And so by the way in which you connect that into the wheel itself, you can either get faster or slower, and if you just switch it out altogether, you get direct, just as if you had no gear at all. So that's how you get three speeds out of it.
And so why did they never call it onion gearing?
I don't know. It's one of those great mysteries, Jack. They missed a trick there, obviously.
I'm not sure. I think we probably confused people more than talking about planetary. I always felt a bit confused by the term planetary gears, because I just sort of imagined the solar system, and what possible relationship does that have to what's going on in this little box? But anyway.
Well, the answer's 42, plainly.
So who came up with this wonderful creation?
Well, the idea of epicyclic gearing is more or less lost in time. But in terms of bicycles, various people were using it in the 1870s, 1880s and so on in tricycles and such like. But the idea of having a compact hub, a very small one, was first patented by an American engineer. It didn't take off, but the idea was then in the public domain, and people could look at it and think, gosh, will it really work made that small? It doesn't seem possible. And the man who made it work in commercial terms was a chap from Salford, son of an Irish couple who probably came over to escape the famine. They set up a dairy in Salford, and he became an engineer at a very young age, and decided to create a two-speed on the same sort of principle. And he went to a firm down the road in Salford, the Green Economizer Company, who made flue economizers. People were into energy conservation even at that time. And they said, yeah, young man, come here, sign this piece of paper and we will take you on and we will make your hub. So he signed the piece of paper and they produced what was known as the Manchester Hub, or just the hub. And it was a two-speed epicyclic gear, tiny, tiny thing, and it really worked. And at the time, the critics said, impossible. They described it as watchwork, far too weak. But the trick that they'd missed, and which Riley and the others had spotted, was that because a bicycle gears up for speed and not down for torque, the stresses in the hub are lower than they are in the crank.
Hang on, I've lost that. Go on, rewind.
Okay. Well, with most machines, when you have gearing, you use the gearing so that your limited power can create more torque. So if you've got a well, so say you're trying to pull up a great big bucket of water from a well, you have a gearing mechanism, so you do lots of turns with the crank handle to get a small amount of motion, but it means that weak little old you or me can pull up this great big bucket because we're spreading our energy more efficiently through the gearing. almost all machines do that, but a bicycle is doing the opposite. What you're doing with the bicycle is making the output faster than your input. So you're pedaling at such and such a rate, and the back end of the bicycle, with a typical bicycle, is going around, the wheel is going around about 2.5 times faster than your feet are going around.
Okay.
So it's speed rather than torque, and it's the torque that is the grunt that does the damage, so to speak, the stress. So because it's in that arrangement, you need a heavy crank, which you've got, you know, your bottom bracket is quite chunky, but you can have a lighter set of gears at the other end because it's
But geared. That only works for making lower gears than direct drive, right?
Yeah. Well, because they're in a range, you can go quite a bit either side. But the practical effect is that you can get away with a much smaller hub gear than you could if you put the same thing in the front end, certainly with the technology of the time. And this was a great breakthrough, that this very small device actually worked. And this was commercially successful.
So who came up with this? Was it Sturmey or Archer?
Well, neither, you see. This was William Riley, this chappy in Salford.
So this is our Irish dairyman?
This is our Irish dairyman's son, yes.
Okay.
So he's gone to this economizer company, sold his soul to them, and they're making this thing called the Hub, and it's a great success, great breakthrough. But he gets fed up. He's a young man, he's done that, and he decides he's fed up with them, and he goes across the river to a new electrical company run by someone called Royce, who later teams up with a man called Rolls, and the rest is history. But this was an electrical company on the Manchester side of the River Irwell, and so he sat there and he's thinking, well, I've done this two-speed hub. It would be even better if we had a three-speed hub. So he designs a three-speed version, but then he realises that piece of paper he signed for the company the first company, has actually got small print in it that says that all his future inventions are owned by the original company. So he can't put his name on it. Otherwise, this company down the road that he no longer has any relationship with is the only benefit, the only company that benefits from it, or the only party that benefits from it. So his mate, who he has his sandwiches with, is a Mr. Archer. So he says to his mate, Mr. Archer, tell you what, mate, I'll, if you sign this, we can go for a patent, and then I'll let you in for some of the money. So the guy who patented Riley's three-speed was Mr. Archer.
Who hadn't done anything at all, apart from be friends with this chap.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's where he comes in. So they go off. This is now a very competitive situation. It's one of these sort of Silicon Valley kind of situations. Everybody's after everybody else, chasing the technology at the cutting edge. Meanwhile, a leading journalist of the time, Henry Sturmey, who was the editor of one of the major cycling magazines, had produced a similar design. He'd looked at the two-speed and come to the same conclusion. It would be so much better if we could squeeze another one in there. So you had two patents applied for within a matter of weeks of each other for very similar devices, and Bowden decided that he needed to get that other one as well, because if he didn't, then his competitors down the road, Humber, were going to get it. And we actually have an account of how Bowden went down to London to the agent who was selling the Archer gear, or the Riley gear, as it should correctly be called. And he's sitting there while the agent is on the telephone to Humber. And Bowden is sitting there trumping the offer that is coming in from Humber, even though he hadn't got proper authority from the board of Riley to do it. He just took a flyer, got the rights to it. So he therefore had the two competing designs, rights to both of these.
Frank Bowden, boss of Raleigh, has got these two alternatives for the three-speed hub gear. Which one does he choose to take into production?
It was a tricky question for him, because he'd more or less committed himself to Sturmey, to produce Sturmey's hub. But when he looked at it, he found that the Riley gear, or the Archer gear as it was known, was actually better, because when you look at it, the one gear was designed by a journalist and the other was designed by a production engineer. And you know, it's not to diss Sturmey in any way, but the other one was a better runner. So he went for that one, which couldn't be called the Riley gear because of the patent situation, but they used Sturmey's name. So they used Archer because the one patent was under Archer's name, and Sturmey because they owned the rights to it, and Sturmey was a very marketable name. And poor old Riley just had to stay in the background, although they did find a job for him.
And did Riley become a wealthy man as a consequence of his great invention?
For a little while, he did quite well. He was mentioned in passing as being an improver of the gear. The sort of spin that was put on it was that all these people got together and brought their knowledge and added it to his, and they added in G.P. Mills, who really did nothing for the gear at all, but he happened to be a senior designer at Riley. And again, he was a record breaker. He was known, so they associated his name with the product. And Riley was mentioned as as just being one of the team who improved things, sort of thing, rather than the guy who actually designed it. And they found him a job as quite a senior job, looking after the production of the gears at Nottingham. And for a while, everything seemed to be going quite well. But he gradually fell out of favour with Bowden and ended up exiting and really losing quite a lot through that. Thereafter, he got no royalties or anything like that. And it was only very late in his life that a little pension was granted to him.
And did he come up with anything else? Obviously, he's a talented guy. He's come up with this great design. Did he come up with anything else that was useful and valuable?
Well, in the early years of Sturmey Archer, there was a whole series of different designs produced. So every year or so, there was a new improved version, or there was a version with a coaster brake incorporated. The famous series of tri-coasters, as they were known, three-speed gears with coaster brakes, a sort of pattern that's very popular in some countries even to this day. That was the sort of follow-up product, and that went through various incarnations. And they even started licensing off their older designs to other companies. So when BSA were trying to produce a three-speed hub, they ended up producing a licensed version of a Riley-designed hub that Sturmey Archer had stopped making, which in many ways was arguably better than the one that Sturmey Archer were making.
And so if we look at the classic three-speed, I guess it's the AW model, that would have been on millions of bicycles in the heyday of cycling in the 1950s. How much in common did that have with what our dairyman's son, William Riley, came up with in the 1890s?
Well, the principle was very similar, and to be fair, very similar to what Sturmey himself came out with. The general workings, the general arrangement was very similar. Most of the effort on the mainstream three-speed standard design, which became the AW, as you so rightly say, after the Edwardian era, was just to make them cheaper. So in some ways, it was a less good hub. The version that BSA made right into the 1950s, for example, you could shift gear. There was no slip position as you had with the AW. If you got your adjustment of the cable wrong, there was a position where you could have your pedals flying around.
And we've all experienced that.
Yes, very painful, especially if you're a male. But that wasn't a characteristic of the earlier Riley one. So basically very similar, but in some respects slightly inferior.
And if we look at Sturmey Archer today, it was spun off from Riley some years ago, and then relocated en masse in a great armada of machines to Taiwan, and still going.
Yes, indeed. That was one of the great sadnesses that came out of this rather poor era of American management of Raleigh. The site of Sturmey Archer had been sold off to the university, and the company was then had something like a year or 2 years to be sold off. And the idea was that whoever bought the company would be responsible for the relocation of the site and any redundancies. And so for that reason, it was sold off at a very low price. In fact, it was sold off for roughly the price of an AW hub, about 30 quid, you know, a trade price, I hasten to add. So a company came in, and in fact, all they did was just strip the assets out. And then basically did a runner. So then Sunrace came in from Taiwan, who had in fact wanted to buy the company before, and they took it over. And now it's a Taiwanese-based operation, and a lot of investment has gone in. So there are new products, new machinery, and all sorts of things going on. But sadly, none of it really in the UK.
And hub gears are experiencing something of a revival, I think. I mean, they've always been popular on the continent with the kind of classic utility bike, but I think people in Britain who have thought of derailleur gearing as where it's at are rediscovering the hub.
Yes, it's one of the interesting things that's happened since the 1980s. The 1980s were probably the lowest ebb. Rally valiantly supported hub gears because they owned Sturmey Archer for a long time, and although they were quite aware of derailleurs, they didn't actually produce a bicycle with a factory-fitted derailleur until the mid-1950s, even on their racing bikes. You had to fit your own derailleur if you wanted one. But by the 1980s, you had a situation where Sturmey Archer were only making three speeds and five speeds. Sachs, or SRAM as it is now, were only making twos and threes, and the same with Shimano. There was very little out there. Since that time, we've had quite a growth because all those companies now exist in one form or another, although ownership may have changed in several cases. And you have twos, threes. We've had fours in the recent past. There are fives. There are sevens. There's an eight. There's a nine. There's an 11. There has been a 12. And there's a 14-speed hub. So by various makers, in that period since that low ebb of the 1980s, there's been quite a comeback in terms of choice.
And if someone's thinking about the choice between a derailleur and a hub gear, what are the considerations that should be weighing on their mind in making that decision? What are the advantages of a hub and what are the disadvantages?
The advantages of a hub are the fact that it is all contained in that magic box that we were talking about. So it's relatively resilient, or it should be anyway, if it's properly made. If you've got a bike that you're going to leave out a lot, you want a low maintenance bike, typical sort of situation you have in parts of Germany and the Netherlands, where people in ordinary clothes ride bicycles to and from work and the office and so on. They don't have to get a lot of hassle. They don't want hassle with changing. They want to dump the bike outside the house or the shop or whatever and leave it there until they need it again. And so you've got a good amount of weather resistance and ease of use, easy shifting when the bicycle is static. So if you're using it in traffic, that's quite an important thing. On the other hand, if you want ultimate efficiency and you've got the trouble of keeping things clean, you're going to go to the trouble of keeping things clean, then a derailleur is generally going to be slightly more efficient.
I have to say, I've had real trouble in explaining a derailleur system to someone who's relatively new to cycling, with two levers essentially acting on the chain wheel and on the rear sprocket, that the fact that these things work together to vary the gears, whereas a hub gear is essentially continuous through the range. And that makes it much easier for people to understand what's going on, rather than fiddling around with changing the gears, or these days it would be with the STI shifters. I mean, the number of people you see cycling around London on a 18-speed with gears essentially working against each other, with the biggest cog at the front and the biggest cog at the back, or vice versa, the smallest and the smallest. It's very common to see. People don't get derailleur gears, do they? Whereas hub gear, straightforward, easy.
Absolutely. And I should add, when you're talking about continuously variable, there is even a hub which is continuously variable with no steps at all, a hub gear.
The infinite hub.
Infinite hub, yes, yeah.
And which are the good products, do you think, that people should be looking at? Which are the ones that are the most reliable, good design, within that magic box, it makes sense, and it's reliable, and something that you can use for a long time without having to service? Because finding somebody to service a hub gear is sometimes quite difficult.
Yes, indeed. It's quite alarming at times. You find people don't really know what you're asking for. You go in there and say, can I have a toggle chain for a Sturmey Archer gear? And they're, what? What's a Sturmey Archer gear, let alone what's a toggle chain? So you can get that. I would give several answers to that. If I was going to go on a round the world ride, for example, I might well go for a roll off a 14 speed hub. Very, very efficient, very, very expensive, but very good. And you have got that continuous range, which is equivalent to something like a 21 or 24 speed derailleur, but it's in 14 evenly spaced steps. Very good backup service, and people have used that hub to go around the world. A very good choice if you've got the money and you've got that kind of a task ahead of you. At the other extreme, there are some very nice simple two speeds, and the old Duomatic, which Fixel and Sachs used to make, which was a two-speed with a coaster, which was operated without any cables at all. You just kick back slightly to change gear. Sturmey Archer have brought out a modern version of that, and I think SRAM are in the process of doing the same sort of thing. Very, very simple. Not everybody gets on with a back pedal brake, but you've got no cables at all, and you've still got a good range. So if you're just riding around most parts of London, the not-so-hilly parts, that two-speed is so much more flexible than a single-speed. You've got no adjustment needed on the coaster brake. That's a nice little hub. I mean, Colin Martin rode one of those from England to Australia, and it proved utterly reliable and very efficient.
And an excellent upgrade for a fashion-conscious fixed-gear bicycle actually want to ride somewhere with.
Yeah, it's the next step up. Yeah, absolutely. And then again, the very basic three-speed speeds by whichever manufacturer, they are amongst the most efficient. When you start putting more gears into a hub, that's when you start to be fighting efficiency or inefficiency. And the basic three speed has always been a very efficient item. You're into the, you know, well into the 90% effective. You're typically talking of something between, say, 93, 94% up to 97, 98, even 99% efficient through one of those. They're relatively cheap. They give a relatively good range. And for bombing around town, you know, I have a three-speed, a straightforward three-speed on my Bromi, for example, and it's great for town work. You know, it was great 100 years ago. It's great now.
And so how about the Shimano Alfine 11-speed, which is a sort of competitor for the roll-off, much cheaper?
Yeah.
How does that fare?
I think that would be pretty good. I've not used one myself, but all the feedback is that it's very good. And indeed, the Sturmey 8, I have used Sturmey 8s, and I found them good. I mean, some people have had problems if they've used them over a very long time, but Sturmey have addressed those. They've made a couple of revisions over the last few years, upgrades to them. And in my own use, I found them very good, particularly if you're looking to get high gears, for example, because the direct drive is on the lowest gear, so all the other gears are gearing up. It's also very nice to know that when you're going up a hill and you've gone right down, you know, to the, you've given in and you've gone to that lowest gear, you are then in the most efficient gear in the hub. There's something very comforting about that.
And when you're looking at your Sturmey Archer hub gear, spare a thought for William Riley. And perhaps we should now and again refer to them as Riley gears.
Absolutely. And there's a very sad little story, because he went back to the northwest of England and spent most of the rest of his life working in a small engineering place there. And there's a sad little story about how when he was, I think he was still working in his 80s, and he was cycling to work one day and felt a bit queasy and sat down in the shop doorway, you know, just parked his bike, sat down in the shop doorway and died. But he was riding a bike, you know, right up to the time he literally to the time he died.
I was in conversation with Tony Hadland, bicycle historian and author of Rally, Past and Presence of an Iconic Bicycle Brand. If you missed the two-part feature on the history of Rally that we broadcast last year, you can find that on the Bike Show website or via the podcast. Tony's own website is an Aladdin's cave of fascinating bicycle history and offers a wealth of technical information on Sturmey Archer hubs. It's well worth checking out, especially if you're fixing up an old hub or have one in need of repair. You've been listening to The Bike Show here on Resonance FM, London's first art radio station. I'm Jack Thurston. Until next week, goodbye.
In this sumptuous hacienda, where are we? To lose in my dick wax running shoes. Underneath the shade of the average tree where they handed out mediocrity, I saw you with alchemy under your arm, standing in the middle of a lawn.
been caught in the jungle. Because there isn't the demand, let me take you by the hand.